हरिः श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवसदि गौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
So summary of chapter 11, Nitya Dharma and deity worship. In the time of Sri Chaitanya, the original town of Navadvip was on the eastern bank of the Ganga. Kulia was across on the western bank and now considered and now consisted of several notable hamlets. Among them, Chinadanga. Once a certain devotee from the Chinadanga merchant community organized a spiritual fair on the premises of the celebrated Kulia Paharpur temple, to which many Brahmin pandits and all Vaishnavas from within a 32-mile radius were invited. Right, so in other words, Navadvip is on this side of the river. And on the other side, there are all these, you know, little villages that eventually turned into what now they call Navadvip. But otherwise, this was Navadvip here, this side, where Lord Chaitanya was living. So that's actually something else. Right? So that's why you have your Kasko Swamis will say on that side is where Lord Chaitanya was born, just to establish that that side of the river is where, because they have some place there. Otherwise, they'd have to, you know, come across the river over here, and there's no people over here, so then they wouldn't make money off of, you know, the temple, like that. Because basically, you go to Yamatsu here, but not very many people would come. You know, so then as time goes, and as this kind is established, then so many people have started coming to this side. But otherwise, before, like at the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, then there was hardly anybody on this side, right? Because it wasn't even known where where Lord Chaitanya's appearance was, like that. Some of the sadhus they knew, but it wasn't generally known in the public. So this Kulia, that's on the other side, and then you also have this Chinadanga, like that. So these little small little villages, and then they eventually turned into what's now Navadvip. Yes.
Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he established where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was born.
Means, but someone he worked for that. Jagannath Das Babaji Maharaj confirmed it, so therefore he's given the credit for us.
Okay. Like that. But some sadhus knew already, or
yes, sadhus knew, but it wasn't as such publicly known amongst the Vaishnavas or anybody that this was the place. There are a few sadhus who would worship the place. But then, because Bhaktivinoda Thakur, then he moved here to find a place. Mm. And he was looking all over and that until finally found this one place. Yeah. And then he built, you know, the first building there. When you go in, when you're facing the deities and the yogpit, on the right there's a small, like, one-story building. That was what Bhaktivinoda Thakur established. That's where his deities were. And then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur built the temple that's there now. Yeah. The festival day saw a teeming mass of Vaishnavas pouring into Kulia from all around. The moving mass of Vaishnavas surged slowly forward and soon arrived at the Natya Mandir, the kirtan hall directly attached to the deity altar of the Kulia Paharpur temple, where previously Sri Gauranga would perform Samkirtan and dance. The businessman devotee sponsoring the festival rushed out to meet the Vaishnavas. He wore a piece of cloth around his neck as a sign of submission upon welcoming his honored guests, and falling at their feet, he rolled upon the ground to express his heartfelt gratitude and humility. The Vaishnavas were then ushered into the Natya Mandir, where they gradually settled down. So around his neck means that that he'd wear his dhoti, he'd have a belt around the dhoti, but on the upper part of the body, he just had a chadar that was hanging around his neck. You know, that style that some will use for, like, doing puja. So that's considered a sign of humility. Immediately, a group of temple sevites came forward to garland the Vaishnavas with prashadi mala. The lead singers began the Sri Chaitanya Mangala Gita, sublime invocatory songs narrating the nectarious pastimes of Sri Gauranga, which further filled the hearts of the Vaishnavas with divine exaltation. So this Sri Chaitanya Mangala Gita means this: before they start the kirtan, there's something that describes the Lord's pastimes, like that. That's the style from Narottam Das Thakur, the Garanhati. So you start opening with the playing of the mridangas and kartals. Then after that you do this Chaitanya Mangala Gita. Then after that, then you start singing whatever specific kirtans or whatever you're going to do. However, as the Vaishnavas reached the heights of ecstasy, the temple gateman came in to make an announcement to the temple authorities. A new group of guests, led by the chief Muslim priest, Mullah Badruddin Sahib of Satshaika Paragana, had just arrived unexpectedly, requesting an audience with a few Vaishnava pundits. The group was waiting in the outer courtyard reception area of the temple. A number of Vaishnavas responded quickly, realizing that a talk with the Mullah Sahib provided a wonderful opportunity to broadcast Vaishnava Dharma. After taking counsel, they decided to send four Vaishnava pundits as representatives. Gaurachanda Das Babaji of Sri Mayapur, Vaishnava Das Babaji of Godrum, that's who's been speaking all along, Prem Das Babaji of Janu Nagar, and Kali Pavana Das Babaji of Champahata. This four should start the discussion with the Mullah Sahib, while the other Vaishnavas could also join the discussion after the completion of the Sri Chaitanya Mangala Gita. The four selected Babajis arose, loudly glorifying Jai Sri Gauranga, Jai Sri Nityananda, and left the assembly following the Mahant for the outer courtyard, where the Mullah Sahib with his group was waiting. The outer courtyard was a large area cooled by the shade of a huge peepal tree. When the Mullah Sahib saw the Vaishnavas approaching, he and his followers stood up as a sign of respect and graciously welcomed them. Knowing that the all-pervading Supreme Lord Sri Vasudeva resides within the heart of all jivas in the form of the Paramatma, and that all jivas are the servitors of Sri Krishna, the Vaishnavas reciprocated their sincere greetings. And gave respect to the Paramatma within by offering dandavats before the visitors. They then sat down facing their respected Muslim guests. So the etiquette of offering that respect or obeisances is then accomplished. The one is that you're simply respecting the material elements of scholarship or knowledge or age or something. But here is that then you're respecting the aspect of that the Lord is within the heart of everyone and everyone is a servitor of the Lord. So that way, it doesn't matter who it is, one can offer respects. So that's also here is then we see that the Vaishnava etiquette, it includes all the other etiquettes. Everything else already works. That showing of respect is already there. So there's not a problem of devotees showing respect to others, right? Because the difficulty is that the element is one may say, well, they're, you know, we're senior, they're junior, this or that. But within this category, that the Lord's in everyone's heart, everyone's the Lord's servant, then, you know, it works out very nicely. They then sat down facing their respective Muslim guests. Pandit Gaurachanda Das Babaji spoke first. O great souls, why have you summoned people as insignificant as us? The famous Mullah Badruddin Sahib humbly replied, Salam, we wish to ask you a few questions. Okay. Pandit Gaurachanda replied, as far as our knowledge allows us, we will attempt to answer your profound inquiries. Right? So the point is, it's not that Yes, we'll answer your questions as much as we understand. We'll answer. Right? We can't answer more than what we understand. Right? But we know that they know a lot. Otherwise, they wouldn't be the ones sent. Right? But yes.
It seems that in those days, those dialogues were quite common between Muslims and.
Yeah, I would say it's because the point is that the religion and philosophy was more important, was considered something more important, so people would always have discussions like that. So, but here we see is that within the Vedic context, and that there would be more discussion, you know, like that, unless just, you know, they're not doing what we're doing, so then if we kill them all, then that's God's will, you know. Like, the point is, they're going to die anyway, so it's not that, we are required to, you know.
Be the instrument.
Yeah, to be the instrument. They're going to die anyway, so it's not that.
Is taboo, is it?
Because the thing is the trees, are they surrendered, you know, like that, you know, the animals, so then. You know, once you kill them all, right? You know, then that would be.
Is religion more taboo today?
I think it's not necessarily as taboo. It's just I don't think people are as interested.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's so many more important things to do. Like, you know, I say the iPhone 5 or, you know, something else, you know, Facebook. Or, you know, there's other things that are, you know, have much more important needs, you know, like that. The Mullah Sahib started, "Dear brothers," because Mullah will mean they're like head priest, like that. I kind of get the idea that they used to also sometimes, I'm not sure, deal with the banking or something like that, keeping money for people. And so also then you have the element that, you know, you have Mullah, you know, so like that. So that. I'm not exactly sure of the connection, but it's in this case, then it means that, you know, he's the leading priest. "Dear brothers, history shows that Hindus have since the dawn of time worshipped many devas and devis. However, we read in our sacred book, the Quran Sharif, that Allah is one, not many. He is formless, and that to sculpt his image and then worship such an image is a grievous sin. To eradicate this doubt, I have inquired among many Brahmana pundits. They all agree with us that Allah is Nirakar, but they argue that since it is impossible to meditate upon a formless entity, so an imaginary form of Allah must be made to facilitate meditation." Right? You know, and you know, complaint may be there, but you have pictures of Muhammad. There's no face, of course, because, you know, you can't do stuff like that. But a form is there, a horse is there, right? I think the horse has a face, but, you know, like that. You know, yeah, that's faceless, okay. Horse, faceless. Yeah, but, so something has to be there. They may say formless, but then there is this little block, there is this little stone, right? You know, and it's not the, you know, the Irish Blarney stone or something like that. You know, so it's, you don't know the Blarney stone? There's a stone in Ireland that it said if you kiss it, then you're able to speak very nicely, very eloquently. The only problem is I think you have to hang upside down and backwards to be able to kiss it.
Okay.
Right, so not necessarily many people do it. But, right, but I think it's popular amongst lawyers and others. You know, English lit majors, you know, stuff like that. Okay. "They agree with us that Allah is Nirakar, but they argue that since it is impossible to meditate on a formless entity, so an imaginary form of Allah must be made to facilitate meditation. Allah should then be worshipped in that form. However, we are not satisfied with this answer because the Quran states that an invented material image of Allah, we call it but, matter, is the work of Satan. But but, parasta, idol worship is absolutely forbidden. Far from pleasing Allah, it rather brings down his wrath. We have heard that the original propagator of your religion, Sri Chaitanya Deva, has pruned out the discrepancies in the Hindu religion, yet he also supports but parasta. Therefore, we have come to ask the Vaishnavas why they have not given up but parasta, despite having delved so deeply into the scriptures. Right? So their problem is why is deity worship going on? I mean, this is a basic difficulty with all the Abrahamic religions, right? Mm-hmm. So this is, and the principle is there, because before we see when Muhammad had come, there were so many deities. Right? Once a year, I think when they have this festival at Mecca, there was the time when all the different tribes from the whole region would all bring their deities. Right, so there'd be hundreds of them, and they'd all come and all that, and that. Why you call it the? I don't know what you call it.
The black stone.
Yeah, no, but the little room that it sits in.
Oh, that's.
Yeah, but that little box, you know, and they always put the nice decorations. So at night they would all stay in there. You know, and then in the day they'd come out, and all this worship would go on. So then Muhammad established that there's only one. So then he got rid of all of them. Like that. So they would be making up. So that was the very common practice. People would just make up their own idea of the deity. So that is what was going on. That was what was addressed. But we're not talking about something that Scripture itself defines as deity worship. Right? Because they didn't have such scriptures. So they didn't know what Pancharatra was. So they were just basically just doing whatever they liked. So that's what he's referring to, but he's not understanding. So that's why his question is, so why is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, why are they still worshipping the deities? Because these Brahmana pundits that he's talked to, they also say that God has no form, but it's very hard to worship no form. So therefore, instead of meditating on nothing, we meditate on something. So Scripture gives an idea of what to use, but ultimately we're giving that up. That's their idea. So he's not satisfied, because otherwise, if you're not supposed to worship a material deity, why are you doing it? Right? The Vaishnava pandits were inwardly amused by the thoughts of the Mula Sahib. Hourly, they requested Gaurachand Babaji to reply, and he quickly accepted this responsibility. The Great One, whom you call Allah, is known to us as Bhagavan. Allah means the one being who is the greatest above everyone and everything. However, we do not consider that a name indicating the quality of unsurpassable greatness alone can be considered the ultimate name for the absolute supreme personality, since we do not consider greatness as the highest or most inclusive description of the Lord. Right? Because Allah meaning the great one. So his point is that it's the name that they take as Muhammad gave 99 names. So they take it that Allah is the main name, the great one. He's making the point that using the term Allah exclusively as the main term to define, then you're limiting your understanding of the actual supreme personality of Godhead. Because you're only talking about his greatness. But as a person, there's so many other qualities that are there. These unlimited qualities. So that's why we'll use the term, if you're using a generic term, as Bhagavan. It means one who has all opulences. So greatness is one of them. Why only one you're acknowledging? Why not all of them? That's his point. Because this will then give rise to understanding the answer better. Right? Because then, you know, to understand what is this Nirakar, what's this formlessness, and what is the actual and the deity. Because that's the problem, is they don't understand that there's transcendental form and there's material form. So the Lord has no material form, he has a transcendental form. So this is the point that is not appreciated. So first he's starting by the Lord has more qualities than one is generally giving him credit for. Rather, we consider that the name that indicates most comprehensively the chamatkar karita, infinite wonder and in uniqueness of the Supreme Lord's unlimited opulences, should take precedence. Right. So the amazingness of the qualities of the Lord, that should take prominence, not just one quality. Right. Because that one quality doesn't necessarily include the others. Right. Mm. Although the name Allah indicates ultimate greatness, it does not indicate ultimate minuteness. which is a further opulence of the Lord. Therefore, the word Allah does not completely convey the complete chamatkarita of all the opulence of the Supreme Lord. In contrast, the designation Bhagavan does denote the entire chamatkarita of the opulence of the Supreme Lord. Right? Because the specific names that one gives is according to his qualities. So if you want to take a name that encompasses all qualities, then Bhagavan will be the term. Right? It means Krishna is the all-attractive. Right? That's for us the most prominent quality, most important. Right? But the point is, if you're just talking about God as a person, then the name that would best describe then is Bhagavan. Because even if you use the term God, it just means the original person. Okay, but the point is what is the quality of that original person? So that's the one who has all unlimited amazing attributes. So that's Bhagavan. So it's a better term. Absolute unlimited opulence, which includes absolute magnitude and infinite minuteness, plus unlimited further opulence, is only the first of the aspects of God indicated by the name Bhagavan. So that's just where it starts. Omnipotence is the second aspect of the Lord indicated by the name Bhagavan. By his Achintya Shakti, the Lord is simultaneously Nirakar and Sakar. Right? So that's why he's approaching the name first. Because otherwise, you're saying Allah is the great one, so how can you, and so he's greater than everything, so how can you represent him in simply some material, you know, form that doesn't have that greatness? So he's pointing out is he's unlimitedly great and he's unlimitedly minute. Because if he's in every atom, between every atom, then that quality is not addressed by Allah. So, in other words, it's not that he has a problem with the name Allah. He's saying that because you're using that as your term of definition, therefore, these other transcendental aspects of Godhead, you're not necessarily appreciating. Does that make sense? So it's not that it's a problem with Allah. It's also a quality of the Lord. But by that, you're limiting your understanding, and therefore, you're not appreciating that God, therefore, can also be in a small form. Right? And he can be formless and have a form at the same time. That's God. Right?
So it can't accommodate a jindabhita-vira-tattva.
Yes. To say that the Lord is exclusively nirakar impinges upon his inconceivable omnipotence. Because if he has all potence, all opulence, means it's coming from something, the source, there's so many unlimited things. So to say he's nirakar, meaning no qualities, but he's omnipotent, means all potencies. Right? So right there, you actually can't say he's nirakar. If you say he has all opulence and all potencies, you can't say he's nirakar, meaning no potencies, no opulence. Does that make sense? So there's a problem in their definition. You know, they know, he'll say he's the supreme person, he's this and that, but he has no form. That doesn't make sense. But the point is, it makes sense if he can simultaneously has form and doesn't have form. Yes.
Can we say those religions are Kali Yuga origin?
Are Kali Yuga origin? Well, it goes back farther because the Abrahamic are based upon the Zoroastrian, and that's the founder of that's mentioned the Rig Veda, so it's a little older. So it's always been around. It's just one of the natural approaches in which they're trying to understand God through the material intelligence. And that, with their own understanding, they're trying to put it together. Because as we see, there's the contradiction there. He's saying Allah's there, he's nirakar. So then, how do you have a form? So, nirakar and form, yes, that goes together. But you're also saying he's the supreme and the greatest one. The point is, but if he's the greatest one, then there's form, there's opulence, there's all these different elements. So, they're not catching in their own definition of God that there's a contradiction. But the point is with God, that's not a problem. Because being the greatest and the source of everything, naturally, details may seem contradictory, because he's the source of all detail. Does that make sense? Right?
And then we can say that those religions.
We could say that they become prominent in Kali Yuga.
And also, they come from the barbarians, so kind of tribals.
It's that it works nicely for the tribals, because for others is that they would take it a little, analyze it a little further.
Like they would the six philosophies.
Yeah, they would analyze it further. And so they also, because if it's Nirakar, there's just nothing there. Or if there is something there, then there's not a problem that he's a person. You understand? So the idea that there is no form and there's nothing there, then you get the it means this atheistic. So it's not actually the Vedas. So it's something distracted from there. So even this Kapila, the atheistic Kapila, that's technically not actually Vedic. His evidences, he uses the Veda. But actually the concept that there is no God, that's not Vedic. Vedic is there is God. Right? So that concept, there isn't anyone, because then we can say, but no, but Shankara, he's also like Shankya is using the Vedas as evidence, but he's actually presenting Buddhism. Because atheism is not Vedic. It's not an option. One can appreciate simply the all-pervading aspect of the Lord and may not know about other aspects. But the idea that there isn't a supreme at all, that doesn't work. Right? So they're kind of touching on different things in that. Yeah, that's the aspect. It's just their different mundane considerations. By his Achintya Shakti, the Lord is simultaneously Nirakar and Sakara, with form, and thus personal. To say that the Lord is exclusively Nirakar impinges upon this inconceivable omnipotence. Through the agency of his omnipotence, he simultaneously manifests his Nirakar manifestation as well as his Sakar manifestation, which is his eternal transcendental form as the very embodiment of his eternal pastimes. Right? So in other words, he's trying to point out is that there's Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. But if you're taking the supreme position, that's Bhagavan. Bhagavan will express it much better as a term. Right? That's why we use that term. Right? Brahman perfectly explains that. Paramatma perfectly explains that. Bhagavan perfectly explains. Right? But they're taking it. No, it's only one. So he's a supreme person, but he's formless. But that doesn't make sense. No, he's the supreme person, and he's formless. Right? I mean, he both are there. But not that he's the supreme person, but he has no form. No, he's the supreme person with form, and at the same time, he's also has no form. Right?
There is only in the Vaishnava presentation that we can have Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan.
Yeah, only in Vaishnava you'll have that. Because otherwise, they won't get past. Generally, most are discussing Brahman or Paramatma. But see, as if you're talking about the Supreme Person, means when they're talking about the Supreme Person, he creates, he maintains, he destroys, they're not talking about the original personality of God, they're talking about his expansion. Right? Because the Purusha avatars are his expansion. Does that make sense? So they never actually get, though he's Bhagavan, but they're talking about him in that basically the localized aspect. So they're discussing Bhagavan but referring to him as Paramatma, actually. So they're not quite, that's the thing, it's mixed, it's not clear. Because it's not an important discussion for them. Right? It's only important as much as he gets the work done. Just like, let's say you have some official government business, and you need to have some papers signed by a government official. So your only interest in the government official is whatever is required to get him to sign your papers.
Yes.
But it's only by him signing your papers that everything gets done. But you don't care about him as a person, what he does, you know, and anything like that. You couldn't care less what he looks like or doesn't look like. You just know that he's a person. You go there, you present the papers, they're all correct. He signs them, you get your work done. So that's generally how they're looking, is that he is the supreme person, and that, but their only interest is he's the one who will give you liberation. Right? So that's the only reason. And so then they'll take their various assistants by logically understanding. So they're not taking it that it's necessarily that mercy. It's just that here are laws, you follow the laws, it works. You understand? So technically you could say it's even though it's all gyan, it's kind of karma. Right? Because of my logic, I'm going to get myself liberated. Because of my understanding of the atomic theory, I'll get myself liberated. Or by analyzing and breaking down the nature, I'll get myself liberated. So it's because of my endeavor that it happens. So when we say karma or gyan, it's not that karma doesn't have any knowledge or gyan doesn't have any activity. It's just which is prominent. Like that. Because that's all there is karma and gyan. So the same thing. You know, it's just two sides of the same coin. It's just which side you're looking at. You know, like that. Allah, Brahman, and Paramatma are generally understood and worshipped solely as Nirakar. Therefore, in this light, they are surely deficient in uniqueness and mystical wonder. The third aspect that the name Bhagavan indicates is that he is eternally all-auspicious and all-famous. Thus, his pastimes are fully nectarious. The fourth aspect denoted by the term Bhagavan is unlimited beauty. The devoted living entities, by acquisition of spiritual purified vision, can behold this beatific form of the Supreme Personality as the reservoir of all beauty. Now, in his description, he's gotten to beauty as the fourth. But actually, beauty is technically the first. All the other ones come out of beauty. But for this discussion, that wouldn't work. You know, in other words, you start with something they can relate to. Right? So that means his power, you know, all these things, these are there. So he's going through the qualities of Bhagavan, but he's going in order that they'll appreciate. The fifth aspect indicated by Bhagavan is that the Supreme Person is the embodiment of unlimited knowledge. This implies that he is absolutely immaculate, perfect, and complete. The embodiment of transcendence, the supreme spiritual object, and materially inscrutable. This, his beatific eternal form as the supreme deity, is the very embodiment of consciousness, beyond, as you say, bute, material time, and elements. Right? So bute is their concept, the material, in other words, the material manifestation. The sixth aspect indicated by Bhagavan is that even as the Ishwar of the entire creation, the Lord remains aloof from everything and fully independent by virtue of his excellence of renunciation. Thus I have enumerated the six primary characteristics of Bhagavan: opulence, power, fame, beauty, knowledge, and renunciation. So then, does this make sense? So it's a matter of how you put it together that makes it that they'll appreciate it. Right? So it's not that you have to adjust something. It's not means, in other words, you're trying to present it so they appreciate it. But it's not that you change anything or leave anything out. You just start from a point that they'll appreciate. Right? Because God being everything, then they're appreciating something. Otherwise, why are they worried about God? Right? They appreciate some aspect. So you start from there. And then, because it is an aspect of Godhead, therefore, you start from that, and then you work in all the others. Right? So then it works very nicely.
And then afterwards, when they accept the six, you can rearrange them some.
Yeah, of course, naturally.
In the right order.
Yeah. No, it's just a matter of just appreciation, you know, like that. But they're all simultaneous. We take beauty as first because that's what's attractive. That's what inspires the living entity to be involved. Because the other things is, how do you relate to unlimitedness, right? We're not very unlimited, right? You know, you could probably say that we're quite limited, you know.
supreme did, didn't it?
Yes, he's probably. Well, I know. Yeah, we're the smallest, but God's still smaller than the smallest.
Well, yeah.
You know, that's the point. But he's unlimitedly smaller than the smallest. So he's the supremely the smallest, yeah, right? Because we're only one small, but he's unlimited small.
Second place is the first loser.
Second place is the first loser.
Okay. So we're not the supreme anything.
Yes, no, that's the point. We're not the supreme. So a devotee, oh, I'm the most fallen, I'm the most this, I'd probably say you're not the most anything.
Yeah, exactly. Right? So it's like,
we're just the humble servant of the Lord, right? Furthermore, the Supreme Lord, Bhagavan, right? Because you had to go through this, because beauty means form. Because the other ones you could take. See, opulence, power, fame, knowledge, and renunciation, no one's going to have problem with. The beauty they'll have problem with if it means form. But the element of beauty or beatitude or that appreciation of that, that even that they'll get. So they'll even partially accept it. It's just the aspect of the form that becomes a problem. Furthermore, the Supreme Lord, Bhagavan, has two manifestations: Aishvarya, opulent majesty, and Madhurya, sweetness. Right. So, an opulent, yeah. The Madhurya Prakash is the supreme well-wisher of the living entities. He comes to his devotees as the dearest lord of the heart, as Sri Krishna or as Sri Chaitanya. If we consider Bhut Parasta to be a term describing the improper worship of a fictitious imaginary form of the Supreme Lord, then this is certainly not contrary to our Vaishnava viewpoint. It means we don't have any problem with that. That they say here, that improper worship of a fictitious imaginary form of the Supreme Lord. We don't have a problem with that. But the point is the scriptures define an actual non-fictitious form. Right? So therefore we worship that. But if somebody makes up anything, that we have a problem with. In Vaishnava Dharma, our practice is to worship the eternal, absolutely spiritual, fully conscious deity form of Sri Bhagavan. Right? Because if it's not eternal, it's not Bhagavan. Right? So that's the point is that that's why for the smartas, even though they consider themselves Vaishnavas because they worship Vishnu and do all the same rituals and everything, they're not actually devotees because they don't accept that the form is eternal. So even for them, that's idol worship. Even though it's the bona fide form and they're using bona fide rituals, it's still idol worship because they don't consider the form eternal. Right? So that's even a more fine element, let alone making something up.
Yeah.
You know. Therefore, the deity worship of the Vaishnavas certainly cannot be defined as satanic idol, material idol worship. The description of such worship given in certain texts is not an absolute and all-encompassing law to be applied without the discrimination to bona fide deity worship of the transcendental form of the Lord. Right? So in other words, the description of what's not bona fide shouldn't be applied to what's bona fide. The point of what's not bona fide is so that one doesn't do something not bona fide, right? The pure method of worshiping, the description of such worship given in certain texts, right, is not an absolute and an all-encompassing law to be applied without discrimination to bona fide deity worship of the transcendental form of the Lord. Right? Shouldn't be applied. Right? The pure method of worshiping the Supreme Lord's transcendental deity form is certainly not possible for the general populace. Only those qualified persons who having overcome the influence of matter are transcendentally situated and can thus conceptualize spiritual form should perform deity worship. I earnestly entreat you to give the subject deep thought. Right, so he's not just saying the general public, because as it mentions, a devotee starts when you have faith that the form of the Lord is eternal. Right? So that's where you say someone's a devotee. That's where it becomes solid. So if that hasn't happened, then that's just an ordinary person. All right? You know, they may be very pious, you know, very nice, do things very nicely. But until that's come, then you won't call them actually Vaishnav. But when that's there, then that's how you define Vaishnav. So that person can worship the form of the Lord. Others actually shouldn't be, because they don't think the form is eternal. So that's what's going to upset the Lord. That's the satanic principle.
Yeah.
Right? Because actually, Satan simply means Maya.
Yes.
Right? So Maya is you don't see it in connection with the Lord. So you're worshiping the form that you don't actually consider is connected to the Supreme. So that, then, is illusion.
Mm.
So then, according to this, that would be satanic.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Mm.
So, in other words, the principle is what they're saying, we agree with. But the point is they're not accommodating the element of Bhagavan and his actual bona fide worship.
Mm.
Right. In those religions, there's a problem of idol worship.
Yes.
Very prominent. What's the basis?
It means the basis, as we mentioned before, is that there was unlimited idols around. And people didn't actually understand. And so then, it means, if we go back to a Mesopotamian city of Ur, you know, and there was one priest, and that priest had many deities, you know, all the stone deities of all the different demigods. And so he would tell his son that here's God. But somehow the son didn't quite accept that. Right? And so one day the father had gone out for some work, and the son, you know, there was one deity that was the biggest. He was considered the main. I think it was the sun god, right? So then he took a stick, broke all the other deities, and then put the stick in the hand of the sun god. When the father came back, then, you know, he saw all this, and he said, you know, what's going on here? What happened? And the son pointed, I don't know. He did it. You know? And he says, how can he do it? He's just an idol. And he says, that's the point. So there's only one supreme God, and all this idol worship is, you know, wrong, right? Somehow it wasn't appreciated. He got run out of the village and everything like that. So he had to go off and start his own religion and all that, and ended up with a lot of sheep and out farther out in the sand like that. So, right? We catch that's Abraham.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Yeah, so then, I wonder if it has anything to do with the, you know, that he's the Brahmin, right? You know, because they're, you know, they were priests, and so it's like that. So then it's coming in that line. So. Yeah?
Maharaj, when you say Satan is Maya, so technically speaking, Satan's not bad. It's where the bad ones. Satan's just doing his job hard.
Yeah. The difficulty is that it becomes confused. See, that's what comes up, this concept of Satan. This is also a Zoroastrian concept. It's not original to that, because understand that area, there's all these different philosophies and all these things are going on. So then taking that there's the Supreme, right, then you're basically lifting the same philosophy, just like Shankara is lifting the Buddhistic and just giving Vedic evidence. So you're using that same philosophy that you have that the Supreme and then those who are against. Then in other words, you had two sets of groups of powerful personalities. You had the demigods and the demons, right? And so, but unfortunately, Zoroaster, his problem was he had it backwards. He took the demons as supreme and the demigods as they were the bad guys, like that, because he worshipped Varuna, and Varuna is one of the sun gods, but he's the lord of the demons, right? All the demons take shelter in the ocean, like that. So in that way, then he put Varuna and the demons together and made them the supreme, and Indra and all that who are against the demons, then they're the bad guys. Right? So it's just, does that make sense? So then he brings out this thing of that eternal position, and you know, Satan, where it's another means God's not in control of the world, Satan's in control of the world, all these things, because if God's in control of the world, why would it be bad? Right? So it's bad. So, you know, in other words, all these different concepts are coming actually from him. And then those are just, they just are continuing on in the line. So therefore, the Zoroastrianism and then the Abrahamic religions, they're just following that same line. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Is that
when
they say it's a fallen angel? Because
a fallen angel, I know, because they would put it the other way. Because Varuna is the one on top, so he's not the fallen one. Because Varuna is not fallen. It's just that he's in charge of the oceans, and the demons just take shelter there to get away from the demigods. So it's yeah. No, it's just, it won't be that connected. Because the thing is you have those who have been, they've left the Vedic fold. And so it doesn't take long before you start to change things or, you know, all those different elements. You know, it's just like you have the point of, you had the Manu, and then when there's the devastation, then he with the Vedas and all that. So then you end up with Noah's Ark and, you know, all these different things. You the stories are there, but over a long time, which story is connected with what, and they start to become mixed, and because it's just coming down in oral tradition. They don't have the Veda to keep it intact. That's the difficulty. So most of those who left the Vedic practice, they went west from India. So in that area, basically from, you know, Iran over, that's the seat of all these different kinds of groups that weren't following the Vedas. So they would be following something, whatever they remembered or some traditions and all that, but it eventually, you know. So that's the point, is that it would degrade down into idol worship, because they're not following Pancharatra anymore. Yes.
That's the area that the modern archaeologists would call the cradle of civilization.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I mean, of the Malecha civilization, it is the cradle. So, yeah, you'd have to give them credit for that. But as far as, you know, humans, it's not the cradle. You know, it does.
It's the cemetery.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's why you find people there. Mullah Sahib, I have seriously considered your points, and I can say that the six primary absolute attributes possessed by he who is called Bhagavan are likewise mentioned. Mentioned in our Quran Sharif in describing Allah, right? Because when he gives the 100 or 99 names, like that. So then they talk about all different things. So all the opulence and everything is described, but somehow or another, Allah has become the prominent name. You know, which is fine if you want to just say that, you know, okay, here's the boss, don't mess with the boss, you got to do what he says. Then that works. But the point is, if there's that element of wanting to please the Lord, then the other qualities would start to become more prominent. Therefore, let us not overly dissect and analyze the etymology of the name Allah. Allah is Bhagavan, the possessor of unlimited opulence. Right. So his point is, let's not overly go into that. He went into it simply because he's trying to expand the meaning. Because otherwise, if you say, here's Allah, and then this is against Allah, on one level you could say, yes, it's against. But the point is Allah has a lot more qualities. So therefore, Bhagavan is the proper terminology. So then we see within that, then form is also there. So then bona fide worship, the bona fide eternal form on the eternal platform by those who believe in the eternal principle, then that's not a problem. But anything other than that, we also agree that that's idol worship and it shouldn't be done. Gaurachand Babaji, very good. Then you accept that the Supreme Being possesses divine beauty. Thus you affirm that beyond this material creation, a spiritual world exists where the Supreme Lord resides as the embodiment of beauty. This very form of sublime transcendental exquisiteness is the deity that we worship. In other words, he resides beyond in that position of beauty. So it's that one that we worship. It's not from here, because the point is from here is the material manifestation. That's Butte. So we don't worship Butte. We worship that form. Mulasai. Our holy Quran Sharif also states that the Supreme Being possesses an absolute spiritual body. Hence, there is no cause for rebuttal. However, when one tries to make an image of that absolute transcendental form of Allah or Bhagavan, the image becomes a material replica. This we call Butte. Worshipping Butte is not the same as worshipping the Supreme Lord. Now, kindly explain your viewpoint on this subject. Right. So now he's established that the Supreme Lord is there. He does have form. Because when we say he's formless, that means he doesn't have material form. So now they've gone beyond this to the transcendence. The Lord has form. He lives in the transcendental world in that form of beauty and relates with the devotees there. So that is that. So they accept, yes, that's accepted. The Quran also is saying that. Right? And so now it's just a matter of, okay, but now you say you're worshiping that form, but you're making that form as a replica in matter. So that's where we have the problem. Right? Because otherwise they're just saying, oh, here's a form, and so it's nonsense. But then the problem is much of the time they also don't understand God does have a form. Right? That he's formless. So then that's a problem. So now he's accepted. No, God has a form. That form is transcendental. It's eternal, residing in the spiritual world. Right? So now it's just down to, okay, but what about the replica of that form? You know, that's not his problem. Gaurachand Babaji. The Vaishnava scriptures espouse the worship of the pure and transcendental deity form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The elevated devotees are not permitted to worship material objects. Those whose spiritual qualification is extremely low cannot understand the pure spiritual state of existence. Even when such people meditate on the Lord within their minds, the form that they imagine is material. And meditating on a material form within the mind is the same as constructing a form of physical elements and regarding it as the Lord's form. That is why it is beneficial for a person on this level of eligibility to worship the deity. Factually speaking, it would be most inauspicious for the general class of people if there were no worship of deities. When ordinary jivas become inclined towards the service of the Lord, they become despondent if they cannot see the deity form of the Lord before them. In religions where there is no worship of the deity, members who are on a low level of spiritual qualification are highly materialistic and oblivious to Ishwara, or in a state of distraction. Therefore, worship of the deity is the foundation of religion for all humanity. So now he's just establishing, he's already mentioned that those who are on the transcendental platform can see this. They don't have a problem. So therefore, the ones that don't see this can understand they shouldn't be worshiping the deity. Right? But the problem is if there's no worship of the deity, then one tends to become more materialistic. Right? Because one needs to be able to focus on something you can see. So they'll just focus on the matter around them. Right? Does that make sense? So this is where your general mass requires deity worship, but the general mass is not qualified to do deity worship. Therefore, you have the temple and you have the pujaris. Right? Does that make sense? But someone who's Vaishnav, then that's a qualification. Right? The form of Parameshwara is revealed to the Mahajanas through the trance of unalloyed jnana yoga, and they meditate on that pure transcendental form in their hearts, which are purified by bhakti. When the bhakta's heart is revealed to the world after his continuous meditation, the image of the Lord's transcendental form is fashioned in this mundane world. The divine form of the Lord, having been reflected in this way by the Mahajanas, has become the deity form, has become the form of the deity. So in other words, the great personalities are seeing the actual original form of the Lord. So in that form that they are seeing in their meditation, that's the form that the deity is made in. Right? The deity form is always spiritual and conscious for those who are on the highest platform of eligibility. Right, so you're eligible. You'll see it always as spiritual and conscious. You're not eligible. You won't see it that way. Those on the intermediate level see the deity as endowed with perception and awareness. This means that the intermediate devotee has faith that the deity is conscious of his thoughts and prayers and accepts his mood of worship. However, the intermediate devotee, unlike the advanced devotee, does not directly perceive the deity as the spiritual, all-conscious form of Bhagavan. Those who are on the lowest level initially see the deity as material, but in time the deity reveals his pure spiritual form to the intelligence purified by spiritual love. Consequently, the deity form of Bhagavan is suitable to be worshipped and served by all classes of devotees. It is unnecessary to worship an imaginary form, but is highly beneficial to worship Bhagavan's eternal deity form. Right. So in other words, he's there. So on the top platform, they see spiritual and conscious as directly the Lord. Right? Then for the intermediate, then they'll see the deity's endowed with perception and awareness. So through the deity, the Lord is seeing, is hearing, is interacting. He hears your prayers. The neophyte may or may not appreciate that, but by being involved in the worship, he develops that faith, and then he comes to that intermediate platform. Yes.
The person doesn't have faith means he sees the deities as material. For him, they are material.
Yes.
Because whatever's
going on, it's just like the Brahmavadi. He doesn't see that there is anything material. Everything's Brahman, because that's actually the position. Everything being an energy of the Lord, it's all Brahman. So this is just an inferior Brahman. Right? But we take it that this inferior Brahman we can enjoy separately without the Lord. So we're not seeing as Brahman, because Brahman means it's the Lord's potency. So we're not seeing as the Lord's potency. So that's what's mundane. Does that make sense? So technically, there is no such thing as material. Right. When we say the material world, we mean the inferior energy of the Lord in which one can view it with a material perception. But nothing's actually material. It's all Brahman. Right? Does that make sense? So it's just a matter of, so that would answer the question, is that you see it separately from the Lord, it acts separately from the Lord. You see a connection with the Lord, it acts in connection with the Lord. Because that energy is the Lord's energy. How you deal with it, it reciprocates. So you deal in connection with the Lord, then you're dealing with Yogamaya. You deal with the Lord's energy not connected to the Lord, she acts as Mahamaya. Does that make sense? So that's what we call material.
So we can say that energy displays its impersonal kind of feature towards people, because devotee can be merciful, and even if you don't want to get the mercy, he can give,
yeah.
And the Lord can be like that. But only Shakti deals like that?
Means
according to you have to do the first step?
No, but also Krishna, he only reciprocates how you deal. You deal as if he doesn't exist, then you don't see him there. You understand he exists in everything, you see him in everything.
Because he can be sometimes like that, sometimes like
yes, so that's why it's sadhana bhakti, because one is developing. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And then for general people, would it be better to worship some kind, any like even imaginary form of God or impersonal? What would be the better form of worship?
To worship a bona fide form. Because the problem when they worship something that's not proper, then they won't understand transcendental form. And if they worship, if they don't accept a form, then the problem is it's very hard for them to acknowledge that. Because that's the difficulty when we're dealing it here. That was his first step, is to the acceptance of the eternal form of the Lord. Because generally speaking, the Abrahamic religions, they have a problem with that there's an eternal form. Though they'll talk about it. You know, God is love and this and that. He wants you to do this and he wants you to do that, and he gets upset if you don't, and if you do, then he's very nice and very kind. But at the same time, he's not. There's no form, there's no nothing. So it doesn't quite work out, you know. So there's no material form, but there's a spiritual form. So, in other words, what you're dealing with here is actually people who are very well read in the scriptures. Because your general practitioner might not understand these things from the Quran. But here, this is why they all came out, because this was the, you know, the Mullah Sahib. He's the big, they're big. So he knows it well, so it's when you point it out, he can see, yes, it's there. So he understands what they're discussing. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the point is you're appreciating the Brahman, then that's the first step in self-realization, but you actually have to know what Brahman is. You know, when you say, means everything, God is everything, everywhere is there. God is everything, meaning the Brahman, not our material concept of it. Right? Our material concept of it is a particular manifestation of atoms in that form because of the result of karma of that. We want to be involved with that. So the Lord arranges through his energies those forms. But he is the potency of that form. That's actually what's the Lord. So that's the Brahman aspect. Right? But that's the para Brahman. And then you have the external energy Brahman. Does that make sense? So means because you have the Lord Brahman, the internal potency Brahman, external potency Brahman, Jiva as Brahman. So four different kinds of Brahman. But the Supreme Lord is the source of the other three. Right. Does that make sense? The Jivas are an expansion of the internal, and the external is the reflection.
Does that mean that before they accept the real form, they won't be progressive in their worship?
Not really, because otherwise, then who are they worshiping?
Yeah.
Like
they don't even know themselves.
No, they don't know themselves, and it's not even that they're worshiping, let's say, earth or fire or something like that. You know, then if you do that, then you're a Wiccan, and then nowadays you can get by with it, but before you'd be burnt at the stake. So, you know, it had at least some connection with something, though it's not very developed either.
I think with the deity form and something else like the Shakti Vesha Avatar, I see that the Lord himself can manifest his own personality through those different Brahmanas. Is that what's happening?
Yes, it's all him anyway, so it's not a problem for him to appear anywhere. But the point is that he appears where he says, means he is everything anyway, but we're trying to see him, so he'll appear in that way in which he says is appropriate.
But he's manifesting Bhagavan through Brahman?
Bhagavan is Brahman. I'm saying they're non-different. But Bhagavan is the source of Brahman. Right. Yeah. Like that. Does that make sense? Because there's Bhagavan Brahman, right? There's Paramatma Brahman, there's Brahma Jyoti Brahman. Then that's in Shakti-man. Then you have in Shakti, you have internal potency Brahman, external potency Brahman, and Jiva Brahman. Does that make sense? Yeah. So then, but because the external potency is simply the shadow of the internal potency, it doesn't have to be mentioned separately. Yeah. Does that make sense? Did you catch that? Then that means there's five. So the Panchatattva. Like that. Okay. Yeah, it is unnecessary to worship an imaginary form, but it's highly beneficial to worship Bhagavan's eternal deity form. And so it's not important. You know, it's not necessary. Because even there is that, you know, even in their own element there, that principle that he was saying, complaining about, is that, but when they do their worship, they sit down because there's no form, but there should be a wall. You know what I'm saying? Or there should be, you know, you're facing Mecca. There's something that has something that can grasp with the mind. So they're doing it anyway themselves. But it's just that deity is what's specifically mentioned. So that's why then they have a problem with deities. But otherwise they're doing the same thing. You know, instead of the deity, then they're taking a wall. You know, or the direction, or like that. You know. Okay. By nature, the jiva is an eternal servant of Bhagavan, and in disregarding and thus forgetting this eternal truth, he has committed a cardinal offense, thus causing his own imprisonment. Removal of this offense is therefore the prerequisite for his release from the material imprisonment. Right, so that was we were discussing. This morning is about the chitta. If the chitta is not purified and brought to pure consciousness rather than polluted consciousness, then that's where the cardinal offense is. Right, we'll say the offense is in, oh, you did this or did that, or the ritual was done wrong, or some materialistic activity was done, or some like this. That's what the problem is. No, the problem is that the cardinal sin is there. That's why these are only manifestation of the cardinal sin. Right? If you change the cardinal sin of I am the controller and enjoyer back to the original I am the Lord's servant and he is the enjoyer. Right? Then you get rid of the whole problem. So removal of this offense is therefore the prerequisite for his release from the material imprisonment. Right? So also we see these others, they're not actually dealing with that. They're simply taking that I have material desire. Right? Means I'm trying to be, there's a particular manifestation of being the controller and enjoyer that's manifest through the mind and matter. So I get rid of that. Therefore, I've gotten rid of this problem. But they want to control and enjoy on the spiritual platform, right? I am Brahman, and therefore I will enjoy being Brahman. Does that make sense? Right, but that's not I am Brahman, meaning I'm servant of the Supreme Brahman, but I am the Supreme Brahman. Right? So it's not a problem that the Supreme Brahman is enjoying. Right? We'll agree with that. The problem is we're not the Supreme Brahman. That's the... So when we're saying you are that means you are Brahman. Not you are that means you're the Supreme Brahman. So that's the difference. In my body's taking you are that means you're the Supreme Brahman. They can't distinguish there. But there's fineness within Brahman. Right? So we're the infinitesimal Brahman, right? And Krishna is the unlimited Brahman. Since time immemorial, the jiva has been entangled in the birth and death, happiness and distress of material life by the insurmountable pressure of Maya, as a result of maintaining this offense of disregard of Ishwara. Nevertheless, if he somehow or other cultivates even a slight interest in the spiritual activity of devotional service to the Ishwara by regularly taking darshan of his deity form and hearing Lila Katha, narrations of Ishwara's pastimes, and he can very soon perceive the transcendental form of the deity. Right? So he takes darshan and he hears the pastime, and very soon he can perceive the transcendental aspect of the deity. The devotional process of hearing and chanting steadily revives his original spiritual nature, which gradually becomes firm and steady. The more the sadhaka grows in purity and spirituality, the more he progresses along the path of realizing his innate bhava, true spiritual mood, and identity in relation to the Lord. Consequently, the soul recourse open to the absolute novice and neophyte in spiritual life is to serve the deity with faith and to hear and chant the deity's transcendental glories and pastimes. This is the prime reason why our Mahajans have established the process of devotional service to the deity. Right, so hearing and chanting, you know, in the association of Vaishnavas, worshipping the deity, right, in the spirit, in the dham. This is then how one wants to situate oneself. From that, then everything will be revealed, right? The nature of the Lord, his transcendental position, will be revealed, right? So it's a complete package. So we see that's the Pancharatrik package. Right? So that works very, very nicely. Yes? No?
Yes, it does.
Very good.
It works very nicely.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nitai Gaur, Krishna ki.